Good evening. Welcome to Congressman Capuano's first telephone community meeting. My name is Allison, and I'll be moderating tonight's discussion. As I mentioned, this is our first telephone community meeting, so please forgive us if there are any technical issues surrounding the next 45 minutes or so. We do appreciate you joining us, and we thank you for that. If you would like to ask Congressman Capuano a question, just press *3 to begin that process. At some point later this week, we will post an audio file of tonight's discussion on our website. And so if you don't have an opportunity to listen to the whole community meeting this evening, you can access that audio file by clicking on our website, and the address is www.house.gov/Capuano. Remember, if you have a question for Congressman Capuano, please press *3. And if you would like to sign up for our electronic newsletter, you may also do so at our website. And with that, I'd like to turn the meeting over to Congressman Capuano, who has a few opening remarks.
Hi, this is Mike Capuano. For those of you who have joined us, I appreciate the time to spend with you. I apologize this can't be done in person, but this year we spent a lot of time down in Washington because we have a new Democratic majority. We have a lot of work to do. Just as by way of introduction, this week we are voting on a few appropriations bills. We vote on energy and water this afternoon. We expect to be voting on labor, health, and education maybe tomorrow, maybe the day after. And then we'll come back next week, finish up some appropriation bills. Not sure, but we think the defense appropriation bill will be on next week. My hope is that that bill will contain several provisions relative to getting us out of Iraq. I don't know whether we'll be able to pass them or not, but certainly we'll be able to have a good debate and maybe pass a few things. But that's where we are at the moment, and that's really just my introductory commentary. I encourage any of you who have any questions or comments that you'd like to pass on to both me and all the other listeners to press *3, and that'll get you going. I guess just by way of kind of catching you up as to where we are, relative to the Iraq war, I'm sure you've all followed all those things. We've had several attempts to try to curb the time that we have in Iraq. Thus far, we have been able to pass it through the House, several different versions through the House. We got one version to the president. He vetoed that. Other versions have died in the Senate or have been amended in the Senate. Thus far, though the American people, in my opinion, are way ahead of Congress, we have not yet caught up. But I also don't think that's an unusual situation in America. I think that's a pretty common situation. And I'm told we have one question.
Thank you. We're now going to take a question from Dean, who has a question about credit cards and student loans and asking what is Congress doing about those issues. Dean, welcome to the community meeting, and please ask Congressman Capuano your question.
Yes. One of the things that I noticed Congress doesn't seem to have any focus on are the abuses of credit card companies, loans, home loans, and student loans that are basically driving us broke. I'm retired, living on a fixed income, and anytime the bank can, it'll jump my interest rate for any excuse and charge $45 fees, that kind of thing. This stuff is loan shark stuff. What, if anything, is Congress doing about it, and what's your personal view of these abuses in the financial banking industry?
Okay, thanks, Dean. There's a couple of questions here. On student loans, we have just passed a bill, I think it was last week, maybe the week before, through the House, and we expect it'll pass the Senate and get to the President, that will hopefully reduce some of the cost of student loans. I have two children. One of them has significant student loans. And we totally agree that we have to get some of the profits, profits not a bad word, but some of the excessive profits out of that business so that students can be able to afford to go to college. As far as credit card abuse, we are dealing with that as we speak. The part of the problem is there is a delicate balance between where should private enterprise end, where should we simply allow the market to determine, and where does government regulation begin? And that balance is always moving. It always changes with public opinion. It changes with depending on the economy. Right now, we've been focusing a lot this year, particularly on mortgage scams or mortgage programs that are generally called subprime loans, which tend to, and again, the concept of a loan that is a little bit higher than market rate to people who are on the borderline of maybe not being able to qualify for market rate, again, that in and of itself is not a bad thing. The question is when it crosses the line to excessive fees and to losing people's homes without due notification. And again, it's easy to identify a problem once you get the most egregious example. The problem always comes in drawing the line. Where is the appropriate line where government regulation should go up to, and where is the appropriate line where we shouldn't go and let the market decide? As far as credit cards go, exactly the same thing. And bounce checks, that's one of the things we're looking at right now, particularly bounce checks, because of the way the banks have made. My understanding is that the profits that banks now make on bounce checks, I believe, is their number one or number two profit-making center in general. And again, it's not a good thing to bounce a check, and it's you know, there is a balance there. Is, you know, someone shouldn't be encouraged to do that. At the same time, part of the problem, as I understand it right now, an example is an ATM card. Many of us use them. We still use them. In the past, when you put the ATM card and you decided to take $100 off, if you only had $50 in the bank, it would notify you, insufficient funds, you can't have that amount of money. Now they give you the $100 and they immediately charge you a bounce check fee or an excessive fee for the excess that you drew over your account without you having a choice. It's one thing if it's your choice, it's another thing if it's not. So I can only tell you that we are looking at them. The general problems are very clear, but the specific problems, which unfortunately is where we have to live. We have to live in the details, not the generalities. These things are a little bit more difficult to draw, and we're gonna try our best to do that.
Thank you. Again, if anyone has questions, please press *3 to begin that process. And now we are going to take a call from Rose from Somerville, who has a question about the Postal Service. Rose, you're on the line with the congressman.
Hello?
Rose, are you available?
Hello? Yes. Oh, do I speak now?
Whenever you're ready, Rose.
Yes. I'm concerned with the curtailment of Postal Service, especially removing boxes from various streets. It's just quite inconvenient and difficult to understand when they're increasing the postage per stamp and other services and decreasing the service. It doesn't add up.
Which kind of box are you talking about? You're talking about the kind where you deposit the mail necessarily the ones for the route? Rose, I wasn't aware that they were doing that. That's news to me. I know that the post office is under severe constraints relative to trying to find ways to make ends meet. Many people are no longer using the mail. They use email now. So therefore, it's putting a lot of pressure on the post office, and they're trying to find ways to cut corners. I did not know that was one way they're doing it. And if you give my office a call tomorrow and let us know any specific location, we can certainly find out.
Okay. Now we're going to take a call from Dorothy from Somerville, who has a question about the Capuano School in Somerville. Dorothy, you're on the line with the congressman for your question.
Hi. It's just the school was built a few years ago, the Capuano School, named after Congressman Capuano. It was supposed to be a crowning glory for the school, a new early education center where the youngest of our community goes to school, children age 2.5 to 6 years old. The school was built as a green school to be environmentally friendly using solar energy and wind energy and whatnot. There was an article printed a number of weeks ago in the Somerville Journal that stated that there was a contaminated site less than 700 feet from the school, and it turns out now after $16.4 million were spent on this school that the school is contaminated. I was just wondering how Capuano felt about this and what's, you know, going to be planned on happening with the school and the teachers who have had to work in it over these last few years of the contamination.
I only read the article myself. I don't know much of the details. Certainly that wasn't known at the time, I will tell you that, because the school, when I left, by the time I stopped being mayor, we had simply gotten the financing and started to assemble the parcels that were needed to build the school. The school wasn't actually physically built, and we actually had done the financing too, wasn't actually built until after I left, so I can't answer for some of the specifics. To my knowledge, that was not known. Any problems in that neighborhood were not known. That particular location has been a park or a residential area for as long as I can remember. There might have been some. I just don't remember any industrial uses there. There certainly might have been, but I don't know them. And as far as I can only tell you that we've had some preliminary inquiries made into the city ourselves. I have not gotten final answers on the matter, but since I'm no longer the mayor, it's not the kind of thing that I would do in the normal course of events. However, for obvious reasons, for 100 different reasons, not the least of which is I still care deeply about Somerville. Number two, obviously, with the name of the school, I have a personal interest. And number three, there's just the general concept of any schools being built in any areas that might harm children or teachers is inappropriate. So I can only tell you that we'll be staying on top of it to the best of our ability, and I have faith that the city will do whatever they need to do to rectify the situation.
Thank you. And just a reminder, if anyone does have questions, please press *3 to begin that process. We do have a number of callers who are waiting to ask questions, and we do appreciate your patience, and we will do our best to get to as many callers as we can this evening. We now have a question from Nicole, who would like to talk about trees and highways. Nicole, whenever you're ready, your question for the congressman.
Hi there.
Hi.
Mike, I live in East Somerville in an area known as the States.
Yep.
And we are right along 93, which I can see from my window. And, of course, I have a lot of health concerns about living that close to major traffic. And I have heard rumor of planting trees along 93. And I wonder if that is so. And how, it, you know, is that a federal money or is that local? And how could that happen?
It wouldn't be federal money. That's not the kind of thing they would do unless they did a major reconstruction of the highway, which, to my knowledge, there's no plans on doing.
Uh-huh.
There's also no room on the federal land. It abuts directly up to private and city-owned land. I can only tell you that when I was mayor, we planted a lot of trees in the States. We tried to plant more trees right along the 93 border. Very difficult to do, as you well know. The streets literally abut. There's no room between the streets and 93. But we did do the best we could in the States area. I'm not aware of any plans to do more or less. I know that the city has an ongoing tree planting program, but I'm not aware that they would target any particular man of the States area that I know of.
Okay, now we are going to take a question from Ron from East Boston, who would like to ask the congressman a question about runway expansion. Ron, whenever you're ready, your question for the congressman.
Okay. Good evening, Congressman.
Hey,
thank
Ron,
you for thank you for keeping up with technology and making this offer arrangement so we can hear your voice instead of reading about it all the time. It's very refreshing. Thank you for allowing Danny Ryan to come to some of our community meetings when we're dealing with problems with Massport and the FAA. He's been very informative and hopefully carrying information back to you as well. My question deals with the expansion of the runway of the center field taxiway. If you know when and if it's going to start, or if you have any input as to what's going on with the Department of Transportation down there and their funding, it's very drastic for our neighborhood here, and look forward to your response. Thank you very much.
The taxiway, I don't know when it's going to start. I think it's going to be a very difficult one to stop, though. We delayed the other runway, 6 years or so. I think if we were fortunate enough to have a different president, we might have had even a better conclusion to it. With the current FAA, first of all, they really don't care about community concerns anywhere in the country. It's just not a top priority for them at all. Number two, the Centerfield taxiway, as I understand it, and I'm not technologically expert on it, but as I understand it, the way it has been presented, it's being presented as a safety feature for planes taxiing around the airport. And that being the case, of course, the FAA looks even more favorably upon it than anything else. And I just don't think we're going to be able to stop it and with this administration. I don't think we're going to get any concern about environmental issues or noise pollution. And I can only tell you that, but I don't know when it's going to start. And I can only tell you that we'll continue the fight as best we can. And maybe we'll get lucky. Maybe we'll win one. Maybe we can delay it long enough to get an FAA administrator that really cares about the community. All I can tell you is the fight goes on, and I'm sure that's not news you want to hear, Ron, but I'm sure you've been involved with these in the past. I know you have. And I can only tell you what we can do.
Thank you. Now we're going to take a question from Alvin from Somerville, who would like to talk to the congressman about impeachment. Alvin, you're on the line with the congressman whenever you're ready.
Okay, thank you for taking my call. And my question is very simply that. Where do you stand on impeachment of the president and vice president? I know that Congressman Kucinich has introduced something about the impeachment of the vice president. I mean, you could ask the question on what grounds, and I would tell you to pick a topic. I mean, there's the FISA violations. There's the manipulation of intelligence that got us into a war that was unnecessary, which has increased more terrorism, is guaranteed that, you know, for our children and grandchildren, for generations to come, they're going to be, you know, hated even more than before this whole thing happened. There's a whole, just the absolute mess at the Department of Justice, and I know that it's, what he's done is not illegal, but it's just a whole thing of politicizing it and making it a wing of the Republican Party, and then the absolute refusal to even cooperate with Congress to allow any oversight whatsoever. I mean, he's setting his precedents for whoever comes in next. You know, it's just taking that one extra step towards fascism, towards having a king. And I'm really dismayed how when the Democrats took power, how Nancy Pelosi said, you know, impeachment's off the table. That's just, I mean, at the very least they should be impeached, but also the groundwork should be laid to convict them, because these guys have so much blood on their hands that it honestly makes me feel very ashamed to even be an American, you know. So I'm curious where you stand and what sort of, I mean, I know that there's ongoing investigations into things, but it seems like it's going at the pace of frozen molasses. So, I mean, what's your position on all of this?
Well, I can tell you two things, Alvin. I agree with everything you said relative to the substance of the issue, plus I can add 10 more things myself. The things that most concerns me are the abuses against personal and freedom and civil rights in this country against American citizens. To me, it's about as anti-American as you can get, some of the things this administration has done. At the same time, I have not signed on to the Kucinich bill, because the Kucinich bill is a direct impeachment. It says the president is impeached. It doesn't say let's have hearings and let's have a process and let's see if it's worth impeachment. And to me, I think to jump directly to impeachment would make this Congress as guilty of abusing the process and ignoring the process as I think this administration has been on 1,000 different levels. So for me, I would never sign on to something that automatically jumped to a conclusion, though I admit it is a conclusion that I have my own personal sympathies with. That's like if you hear the news that somebody robbed a bank, you probably make your own determination whether you think that person actually did it or not. At the same time, you would never convict them without a due process hearing and without, if you were on the jury, trying to clear your mind of any prejudices or any thoughts you might have. And I would say we have an obligation to do the same thing for the president and the vice president. I would tell you unequivocally that I would never favor impeaching the president without also impeaching or going through the process of impeaching the vice president, because the last thing I ever want to hear is President Cheney. So as far as I'm concerned, if we're going to do one, we have to do both, and we have to give them the due process that they have refused to give thousands of Americans and many other people around this world, to my way of thinking, in an un-American fashion.
For those of you just joining us, if you would like to ask Congressman Capuano a question, please hit *3 to begin that process. And at some point over the next couple of days, we will have an audio file of this community meeting posted on our website, and the address is www.house.gov/Capuano if you missed part of this meeting and you would like to check out the rest of it. You may also sign up for our electronic newsletter via the Congressman's website. And now we are going to take a question from Deb, who would like to talk to Congressman Capuano about Iraq. Deb, whenever you're ready, your question for the congressman.
First of all, I want to say there are people like me who grew up in Somerville and are so comforted that there are good people in Congress. That being said, tonight there were statistics on the national news and in the Times about where the Republicans are in terms of the presidential election. And those numbers are clearly very, very low. So clearly the Democrats are positioned to do well, I pray. And that being said, the current office has done a very good job in frightening us that the war will come here if we leave too quickly. And if the Democrats hopefully win the next election, how do you think, are they prepared to make these types of very difficult decisions in terms of transitioning out and creating safety for all people?
Well, Deb, I can't speak for the presidential candidates. Obviously, they'll have to speak for themselves. I can only tell you what the House has been doing since we took the majority. An overwhelming majority of the Democratic caucus supports us getting out of Iraq within a very short period of time, in order basically just to allow the safety of our own troops. Unfortunately, that doesn't make a majority of the House, and we have to get 218 votes. And several Republicans have said the right things. Only two have consistently voted with us to get us out of Iraq at some short and foreseeable future. Little by little, my hope is that the handful of Democrats who are left that don't agree with us, and the Democrat and the Republicans who have said the right things, will eventually vote their conscience. I think it's only a matter of time. I think the American people are way ahead of us on Iraq and understand that this war was wrong to get into and is wrong to stay in. Now, that doesn't mean that if we leave that all of a sudden everything's going to be rosy. No matter what we do, terrorism is a real threat in the world today. The question is, what are you willing to do to balance that threat with our own civil liberties and our own personal freedoms? And for me, that's a very difficult question, because obviously I want to provide safety, but at the same time, I don't want to become a country that that has to carry papers and show them to every officer on the street, and it's a balance. So all I can tell you is that all of us want a safe America, no matter. And there are those who will get up and demagogue the issue on the floor of the House and accuse those of us who are concerned about civil liberties of being weak on terror. That's ridiculous, and I have faith that my constituents understand that. At the same time, it is important to be tough on terrorism when you can. I do not believe that by us staying in Iraq, it will keep the terrorists away from our country. I think it is a totally unrelated issue. I believe that us going into Iraq have actually made it a more dangerous world. I believe that we have created more terrorists by doing it. But we are where we are, and that's no matter what. I have not heard a single argument yet that would make me change my mind and want me to stay in Iraq. I think there is no reason for us to be there. I do, however, say very clearly that we don't know what's going to happen when we leave. And anybody who says they do is lying and fooling themselves and trying to fool the public. We don't know. We can make educated guesses. We can try to figure it out, but we don't know. And that being the case, I do agree with Representative Murtha's general position that we will have to keep troops in the region for the foreseeable future. The region is not in Iraq. It could be in Saudi Arabia. It could be Yemen. It could be Turkey. It could be Germany. Because we don't know what the contingency is going to happen. And I also believe very firmly that we have to finish the war on terror that is really still in Afghanistan and on the Afghanistan and Pakistan border. However, this administration continues to try to fudge the issue. They continue to ignore the real threats that we have coming out of the territories, the tribal territories of northern Pakistan. And they keep trying to focus on Iraq for reasons that are beyond my comprehension. But I do believe that we will start withdrawing within the next year. The only difference is, for me, that's, several years too late. But we will continue the push, and I believe we'll all continue to fight for a safer America.
Again, if you have a question, please hit *3 to begin that process. We have a number of callers who are waiting. We do appreciate your patience, and we're doing our best to get through as many as we can. And now the congressman will take a question from Ann, who would like to talk about Notch babies. Ann, whenever you're ready, your question for the congressman.
Yes, Mr. Capuano. I've been helping you a lot, and I've lost a lot of money on that Notch. I was born in the wrong years, and I was wondering, they say they were going to get $5,000 for each person. There's not too many of us left, and I was wondering what they're going to do about it.
My mother is also a Notch baby, and I never knew about Notch babies until I got elected to this job, and my mother explained it to me clearly. I can only tell you that there are many of us down here who want to push for it. It is really just a matter of financial priorities. To me, the Notch babies actually lost a benefit that they were told they had. It's a different situation and should be a higher priority than giving advantages to people that, you know, we would like to help. But they didn't lose anything. This would be something new. I don't know what's going to happen with it. It is a lot of money. I don't know the exact number off the top of my head. It is a lot of money that's involved. There are actually more Notch babies still around than you might think, Ann. And that's good. My mother is, as I said, included in them. At the same time, the amounts of money that they would take to catch everybody up would be significant. I have not heard anything about this issue being solved. in anywhere in the near future, and people who tell you that it will be, I think, maybe misleading you.
Thank you. We now have a question from Michelle, who would like to ask the Congressman about airplane traffic in Somerville. Michelle, you're on with Congressman Capuano whenever you're ready.
Good evening, Congressman.
Hi, Michelle.
Hi. First of all, I'd like to say that it's a shame that you're not the mayor of Somerville anymore.
Thank you.
I wish you could get out of Congress and come back to the city of Somerville, because we really need to have a mayor who would do things for the people who live here. But my question is the last past couple of weeks, I live in West Somerville, and there has been a lot of increased airplane activity flying low all morning, all hours of the day. I would like to know who changed it and why we weren't notified that the planes were going to fly this low and at all hours of the day.
Yeah, I'm not aware of, what height they're at. I mean, I've actually gotten several complaints about it, and I live on Winter Hill, so I hear them as well. They fly, actually, they don't fly over Somerville. Most of them fly over Medford, but close enough for us to hear it and hear it loudly. As I understand it, because I actually made some calls over there, my staff made some calls over there to find out what was going on, nothing has been changed. It's simply been the weather pattern. The weather pattern has been overwhelmingly coming from the wind directions out of a certain direction that has caused them to use runway 1533 more frequently than they have in the past. And so it's my end, at least that's what we were told, and I have no reason to disbelieve them at the moment, that the increased activity over this particular air corridor has more to do with weather. It is almost exclusively with weather more than anything else. To my knowledge, there has been no policy changes, no shifts. It's just, I don't know if it's global warming. I don't know what it is, or just one of those weather patterns. But I've noticed it as well, and I will tell you that you're not the only one that has brought it to my attention. We've heard it from Charlestown, from East Boston, from Somerville, and you're not wrong. You are 100% correct, but that's at least what I've been told is the reason. And I've actually checked with the weather system, and my understanding is that I have reason to believe that they're telling me the truth.
Thank you. We now have a question from Jed, who would like to ask the Congressman a question about trade issues. Whenever you're ready.
Hello, Congressman.
Hi, Jed.
Hi. It's a question about U.S. foreign currency reserve holdings. I'm under the impression that the Chinese have $1.3 trillion worth of foreign exchange currency reserve holdings, and that we have somewhere between $66 billion and $70 billion. This is from research that I managed to get off the web at various times, including recently. I wondered whether you're aware of this data, and whether you consider it a problem, whether you consider the trade imbalance contributing to the this meager, relatively meager foreign currency reserve holding. Because, I mean, in the event that some other power decided to, as they say, attack the dollar by selling it, we would have relatively meager means to defend the dollar if $66 billion is a relatively small amount of foreign currency reserve holdings. And I'm sort of a neophyte in this. You know, I mean, I'm interested in it, but I don't really know a lot about it. And I wondered whether you are aware of this problem, whether you support trade protectionist measures like the one advocated by Senator Dorgan, Byron Dorgan of, I think he's from North Dakota or South Dakota. Thanks.
I'm not aware of those specific items, no. I don't know how many foreign dollars we hold or is held by others. I am very much aware of the trade imbalance that we face, not just with China, but with pretty much every major country in the world. I don't know Senator Dorgan's specific proposal, so I can't answer how I feel about it. I can only tell you that, in general, I have voted against all but one of the trade accords that have been proposed since I have been in Congress. The only one I voted for was with Australia, and my argument is if we can't trade with Australia, who have similar unions, union issues, similar environmental concerns, similar social issues, similar concerns about equity, if we can't trade with them, we can't trade with anybody. At the same time, I will tell you that it's pretty well known that Massachusetts was built on an international trade, and still we generally enjoy a surplus in trade. But it's because we don't necessarily compete with those foreign countries in the areas of their expertise. In the old days, my grandfather worked in a shoe factory. We no longer make shoes in any real serious. I mean, we make some, but not very many. It's not the basis of our economy. The basis of our economy is now high-tech and high-tech-oriented, such as venture capital and banking and insurance and things like that. And no one can compete with us on that yet. So that for me, every trade issue is about what is good for America, and that's somewhat what's good for the 8th District. As far as the 8th Congressional District goes, as I said, we have a trade surplus with most countries, and it's difficult for me to vote against those trade agreements because on some levels I'm taking money out of the pocket of my own constituents in some degrees. At the same time, that's not necessarily the best thing, I think, for the future of the 8th District, for Massachusetts, or for the country, because I do believe that if we're going to compete on an economic basis with anyone, that we need to compete on some fair level. And there's no way we can compete with a country that refuses to allow people to organize so that they can make a living wage. It refuses to provide health care. It refuses to provide environmental protections. They're competing with, as far as I'm concerned, unfair advantages. And that being the case, I don't see why we should enter into trade agreements that ship jobs, American jobs, overseas and get nothing for us except some short-term economic benefit. And until those things change, I do believe in trade, but I believe in fair trade. And the definition of fair trade in my mind is trade that we have, well, there won't be equals, but two people on the same footing, heading in the same direction, doing business together. And that has not been the case in most places in this world. And I don't think that this administration has any interest at all in changing it. I think they're much more interested in the short-term benefit to a handful of very wealthy people as opposed to the long-term benefit for the good of this country.
Thank you. We're now going to take a question from Steve from Somerville, who would like to talk with Congressman Capuano about No Child Left Behind. Steve, whenever you're ready, your question for the Congressman.
Hello, Congressman. I'm a teacher living in Somerville, and I'm a middle school teacher, and all of us have been affected by No Child Left Behind. And I know it's up for renewal, and there are some problems. I see that I teach a lot of immigrant students who have come here 10, 11 years old from countries where they had literally no education. And within 2 years, we expect them to pass a test on an eighth grade level. You know, we teachers, and we say, you know, we don't even think they can really yet understand the fourth grade test. And yet we're held accountable for this. Also, children who are cognitively delayed, who really are working hard, but we know they're not ready for a test on their grade level, but are making educational progress. What changes would you like to see in No Child Left Behind?
Well, and I don't think we have enough time for all those, but I can tell you one thing. It's one of the best votes I've made since being in Congress. I voted against the No Child Left Behind Act. And it was a very difficult vote, if you want the truth, because a lot of people had faith that that something would change. And my problem is when the bill was drafted and passed, I saw nothing more than the same old nonsense about more testing and all the children of this generation are stupid and we're smart. And I didn't see anything there that would actually move education forward. And unfortunately, several things, unfortunately, I think, the position I had at the time turned out to be the right one. My hope, and it is up for renewal again this year, and unless they make dramatic changes, then I probably won't vote for the bill, but it depends, and I think that the people running it now are probably in a better position to make some of those changes. The kinds of changes I know this may sound silly and trite, but I really do think that basic education is the most important thing. We're not doing our children any good if they can't read and write in a manner that's appropriate and necessary in today's day and age, which it's a little bit broader than that. It's not just simple mathematics or a simple grammatical tense. It has to do with being able to communicate to your fellow citizens, to your fellow coworkers. It's to be able to understand something that you read. It's a very difficult world out there in business today. You have to be able to understand spreadsheets. You have to understand how to balance a checkbook. We don't teach our children even that kind of basics. So as far as I'm concerned, I'm going to be looking for some of those things. I don't mind testing. I think that's, you know, that's the rhubarb that, that people will grab onto all the time. Oh, you're for low standards. No, I'm not for low standards. I'm for high standards, but I'm also for high standards that are actually going to result in a smarter child, not just one who can regurgitate facts a little bit better than they could in the past. And I think it is very difficult to get beyond a lot of the requirements that we have, that we currently have, that I think will not necessarily make a child more more capable of competing in the business world today. And I think we have a long way to go. And I will tell you that it's not just the No Child Left Behind Act. I think that on many levels it's been many of the states all across this country that have claimed the mantle of education reform. Basically, their definition of education reform is to simply provide a test. They don't even know what they want to test. It takes them years to come up with the test after they pass these laws, as opposed to knowing what they want before they go into it. And I'm not so sure. I'm not at all. I don't have a whole lot of faith that the people who get involved with so-called education reform really know what they want. They simply want to test children and feel good about themselves, I guess. And, of course, my argument is if you feel that good about yourself, maybe you should go online and take one of these standardized tests and just see how well you do as if you think you're such a smart adult. The things kids have to know today to compete are a lot more difficult and a lot more complicated than they were 20 years ago or 30 or 40 years ago. And I think the sooner people realize that, the sooner the adults who are running this process realize that, I think the better off we'll all be.
Thank you. Our computer program is telling us that we have a number of callers who are waiting to ask questions, and we do appreciate your patience. We're doing our best to get through as many as we can. If you do have a question, you need to hit *3. And now the congressman will talk with James from Cambridge, who has a question about Section 8 reform.
Hello.
Hello. First of all, this is certainly an improvement over right-wing talk radio. And I appreciate, I think it's a great idea, and I hope you'll consider doing this on a regular, on an ongoing basis. So, thank you.
Thank you.
I also want to first clear something up that I'm confused about, which is the pronunciation of your last name. I'm sorry. Is it Capuano or Capuano?
It's either way. The old Italian way is Capuano. It's kind of a silent W-U type of thing.
Uh-huh.
But, when I say that, a lot of people don't necessarily follow it, and they start misspelling my name, and so therefore I tend to do it phonetically in a more Americanized way, which is Capuano. But either way is fine by me.
Okay. Well, I prefer the original way then. Thanks. I have a kind of a threefold question. I'm actually here at a meeting of tenants and in Cambridge, and one of our topics at the meeting tonight is something called the Section 8 Reform Bill,
yep.
SEVRA, which just passed the House on July 12th.
Right.
And the consensus here is to commend you for what I think everyone presumes is your role in this legislation, which is apparently going to fix voucher funding formula problems, and the Section 8 voucher is sort of like one of the affordable housing programs in this country, well behind the home mortgage deduction, by the way, but nevertheless an important element in affordable housing. The funding for it, and perhaps you may have a comment about it and where it's going and how it can be supported, but the funding, looking at a report from National Low-Income Housing Coalition memo to members, the funding is just pitiful. You know, it's at the level of, you know, an additional, trying to get the exact numbers here, but you know this better than I, $61 million, the Senate bill, maybe $500 million here and there. And it begs the question, when now the other element of the question really is the current spending level, as I understand it from a recent report on Congressional Research Service on the war in Iraq, is that that's now estimated to be, just Iraq, leaving aside Afghanistan, is now $10 billion a month, something I'm sure you're very well aware of. And it just seems to me that this really begs the question of, you know, really moving as swiftly as we can to defund the war in Iraq. And you've already been asked about it, and you've already spoken to this. I'd like to also tie in I think something I think you're also very involved in and interested in, which is Amtrak funding. I read.
Okay, James, we get a whole bunch of people.
Okay.
Let me talk about housing for a minute.
Okay.
All right. Bottom line is the bill that we just passed is a great bill. I mean, it doesn't answer all the questions and all the problems we have, but it is a great step forward. I will tell you that for the last 8 years I've been here, every single time we talked about housing, poor and middle-income people got hurt because this administration does not believe the federal government on any level should be involved in the housing business. This is a bill that starts us back in the right direction because I believe the federal government does belong in the housing business. Otherwise, it would be hundreds of millions of people in this country. That, I'm not talking about just the poorest of the poor. I'm talking about a lot of middle-class people who got mortgages because they could afford through things like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. But anyway, this bill is a great step forward. At the same time, funding is another issue, and funding is because right now we're competing with all kinds of needs and all kinds of problems that have been created by this administration, not the least of which is the largest deficit in the history of the country. We have a huge financial deficit. This country is, for all intents and purposes, bankrupt. We cannot do all the things we want to do as quickly as we want to do them. So when it comes to financing a lot of the things that we want, it's going to take us some time to turn this ship around. We have to balance the budget, and we have to reprioritize things, and you don't just shut down most things. As far as the war in Iraq, I want to make it very clear to everybody. I mean, I don't oppose the war in Iraq because of financial issues, and not that you suggested it, James, but other people have. If the war was a moral war, was a war that we belonged in, World War II being the most classic example, if it was a moral war, then money wouldn't matter. You spend whatever you need to spend to do the right thing by your own citizens and by the world. The war is wrong because it's wrong. It doesn't matter about the money. However, at the same time, you're right. The $10 billion number is a number that came out of a nonpartisan study by a group, the Congressional Research Service, that is well-respected by everyone down here. But I want to make it clear, that $10 billion is being borrowed. It goes back to the issue that was discussed a few minutes ago, the trade bill and the deficit. Part of what we're doing is because of this budget deficit that we have, we are selling bonds all around the world. The largest bondholder, or the second largest bondholder in the world right now, is China. And what they're doing is basically we're borrowing money from China to fund the war in Iraq. Now, that's a little oversimplification, but it's somewhat true, and it's made, to make a point. If we stopped the war in Iraq tomorrow and we wanted to be financially prudent, there would not be a single penny to turn into domestic programs. All of that money is being borrowed from our children and our children's children, which is obscene in my mind. So I'm not going to say that we won't have any money to put, totally no money to put in domestic programs. We will have some, but it's not free money. This money is being borrowed. We do not have it. We simply just made it up because we're the federal government. We can do that. And that, to me, takes a bad situation in Iraq and makes it insulting.
Thank you. We are now going to talk with Mike from Cambridge, who has a question about the military budget. Mike, whenever you're ready, your question for the congressman.
Hello, Congressman. Mike Brower from Cambridge.
Hey, Mike. How you doing?
Good, thanks. A quick footnote on your recent comment about the MCAS and National No Child Left Behind testing. I believe that the purpose of any level of school is essentially to prepare children for a lifelong of learning, because nobody could possibly learn enough in grade school or high school or anywhere else, so we've got to do all the, as you said, teach reading and math, but testing is not the way to do it. We've got to encourage kids to spend the rest of their life learning, because that's the complex world we live in.
I agree with you.
I agree with everything you said about the Iraq War, except a little bit disagreement about the last piece. I want to raise with you the issue of the huge bloated American military budget and the attitude of trying to control the rest of the world, basically imperialism, that lies behind and is fed by this ridiculous Cheney administration invasion of Iraq. When we do get out of Iraq, and I should say if, but of course we will eventually, they're talking about leaving troops to protect American military bases, 6, 7, 8 military bases. They're talking about leaving troops to train the Iraqis.
Yep.
And we've got, as you know, paramilitaries or whatever you call them, private contractors there, probably equal to the number of troops. And nobody's saying, well, can they stay? And behind that lies the myth that the U.S. can dominate the world militarily. As you know, our military budget is as large or larger than that of all other countries combined. So my question for you is twofold. what can you do to persuade Congress to tell the full truth about the amount of American military spending, because it's hidden in half a dozen different budgets? And secondly, what can you do in Congress to get that dramatically cut and turn the American policy around to being a good citizen in the world, providing foreign aid to help deal with poverty, the underlying causes of terrorism? And thirdly, what can we do outside of Congress to shift our country's attitude from one of dominating the world and imperialism to one of being a good neighbor?
Well, the last one, Mike, you're kind of a leader on that. I mean, there are a lot of people out there who are doing their best to change the attitude of the American public. And that's the only way you're going to change how this country runs, because it's not just a president. There's also a Congress that 435 members of the House are elected by the same number of people. We all represent, give or take, 650,000 people. And when America changes its mind, then Congress will change. I think that the only way that happens is for the American people to lead. Though I'm a politician, I've always believed that most politicians do not lead most of the time. We generally follow. We follow the American public. So when the American public says something, if they say it loud enough and clear enough and long enough, we'll hear it eventually. And if we don't hear it, then they'll replace us with other people. As far as the military budget goes, I mean, that again, that's like anything else. I mean, first of all, yeah, it's bloated, but at the same time, it is important to have a strong military that is well equipped. If we want a small military, which I think we do, I think we all do, then that military also has to be the most technologically capable military we can get, and that is expensive. How expensive, that's always a question for debate, and exactly what do we need? I mean, the Star Wars the proposal that they've been pushing for years is a classic example. I, for one, think that the research on being able to do the Star Wars is not necessarily a bad thing. That's a good thing, because if we, God forbid, we ever need it, we should be able to build it quickly, and it should be tested on a scientific basis as opposed to just some cartoon character. At the same time, we don't need it now, and there's no need to build it, and they're building it anyway. So that there are many ways we could cut this budget. At the same time, we're not going to be able to zero it out. We're not going to be able to shut it down dramatically. But we will be making progress, I believe, this year, and certainly changing some of the priorities relative to some of the things we just talked about, and particularly the Star Wars proposal. I think you'll see some dramatic cuts in that this year. And again, I think that you won't get that until you change the attitude of the American public, and the American public sends us members of Congress who are willing to support that. In the meantime, we're stuck with trying to push the rock uphill, and many of us are going to continue to try to do it. But as you know, Mike, I consider myself a realist, and I don't think we're going to be able to do this overnight, and I'm not convinced that we can do it in the long run, but I know one thing, that it will definitely not get done unless people like you and me keep pushing it and keep trying to move this country forward.
Thank you. Looks like we have time for just a couple more questions this evening. We appreciate everyone's patience. And Congressman, we'll now talk with Larry from Somerville, who has a question about Darfur. Larry, whenever you're ready.
Hi, Congressman. Thank you for doing this. Barney Frank has offered a proposal to release corporations from their fiduciary duties to make profits in the face of companies and investment firms that are profiting from human rights abuses, such as those in Darfur and elsewhere. Do you know if that is coming to the fore in the Congress? Are you supporting that? And can you say anything more about it?
I'm not familiar with that specific proposal, Larry, so I don't know.
Would you support such a proposal?
I'm not sure it's necessary because there's no major profits being made in Sudan, number one. Number two is nobody has a fiduciary responsibility to support a genocide. I've had these arguments from some of my own state officials in Massachusetts who refuse to divest some of their pension funds, and they say, well, we have a fiduciary responsibility. Well, my argument is you have a fiduciary responsibility to humanity way before you do to a bottom line, and it's not as if the only place in the world you can make profits is in Sudan. That is not true. It's not even close to true. The profits you can make there are no better and no worse than any place else. So I mean, I'd support anything it takes to stop this genocide. I believe that it's completely against humanity in every level. And I just can't imagine my own country that sits by idly and lets this happen. And any public official in any capacity that allows it to happen, even a private official, I firmly think, I shouldn't be mixing politics with religion, but I think they're going straight to hell and probably deserve to do so.
We'll now talk with Thomas from Somerville, who has a question about the war in Iraq. Thomas, when you're ready, your question for the congressman.
Congressman, it's an honor.
Nice to talk.
My question has to do with an undeclared war, which has been all too common a practice in U.S. foreign policy really since the Korean conflict. I think there should be a time limit on, you know, an executive branch to, you know, going into, you know, in this case, Iraq. There should be a time limit on such a conflict. I think it's very important that Congress officially declare war one way or the other. And we didn't do it in this conflict. And I think given the cost in money and in lives, it's distressing. I think this country is a very moral country in many ways, and you know, it disturbs me that we've been in a conflict that's, correct me if I'm wrong, exceeded the time frame of the Second World War, and it's still an undeclared war. There should be a limit placed on such a conflict. I mean, I think it's kind of a clever kind of executive branch maneuver that they did, but you know, I think morally, if we go to war, there should be a vote in Congress on such an act.
I couldn't agree with you more. There was a vote on this. There was a resolution, and many members now say, well, we didn't mean it that way. Well, they did. Everybody who made that vote that day knew that this president was going to go to war with Iraq at some point. So I find it hard to believe that anybody who voted on it then, they may have made, people do change their minds, and that's fine. That's a different thing. But I think it's almost impossible for anybody to look anybody in the face and say, gee, I didn't know he was going to go to war with Iraq when I made that vote. We did have that vote. I thought it was the wrong vote at the time. I'm proud to have voted no. And I want to make it clear, I'm not some sort of a peace activist at all costs, though I respect people that feel that way. That's just not me. I do feel that there's a need for military action on occasion. I voted to go into Afghanistan. I thought that was the right vote. I think it's the right vote today. I am currently trying to get U.S. troops into the Sudan. So there's a time and place for military action, in my opinion. As far as a vote goes, I couldn't agree with you more. We have tried everything we can try. We're going to continue to do it to get us out of Iraq by putting time limits on, by possibly we're talking about repealing the original resolution that allowed this president to go in. I don't know if we'll have the votes to do it, but we're talking about it at the moment. For instance, I'm concerned this Congress has actually gone on record in preventing us from saying to the president that you must get our approval to attack Iran. I agree with you 100% that Congress has a legal and moral obligation to have a say on war and peace, and I would hope that every member of Congress makes that vote as a matter of conscience. Look, I'm a politician. I want to keep my seat, and I will do political things on occasion, and I will subject my own personal opinion to what I think is the will of my voters on occasion, but not on war and peace. It is too important. There is nothing more important that we do here in Congress, and I totally agree with everything you've said.
Looks like we have time for just about one more question. We apologize to those of you we weren't able to get to. If we do not get to your question and you would like to leave a voicemail for Congressman Capuano, you can stay on the line and you can leave a voicemail for him. We now have time for one more question, and that is Anne, who has a question about Social Security. Anne, when you're ready, your question for the congressman.
Oh, good evening, Congressman. Thank
Hi,
you for
you?
Taking my question. My question has to do with Social Security. As you know, Massachusetts is one of, I think it's 14 non-contributory states, which means people that worked for municipalities or who were teachers and whatever and were getting some kind of a state pension were not allowed to pay into Social Security. However, many, many of those people would have been entitled to Social Security because of a spouse who worked under Social Security or because they themselves worked enough, you know, have enough units to get the Social Security. However, in some cases, as is mine, we get zero, and in other cases, the Social Security is reduced by about two-thirds or so. Now, the government pension offset and the windfall elimination provision really it causes hardship on a number of individuals that I know personally. A number of them are struggling. These are retired teachers on meager pensions. I'm talking about less than $15,000 a year. These are people who worked years ago when the salaries were small, the pensions were small, and they are facing great, great hardship. What do you think is the possibility of the GPO and the WEP being repealed?
Well, Ian, let me tell you that I am one of those people. When my time comes under current law, I will have an offset too, because I will by that time I'll be eligible for both a city pension, which is the same as a state pension, and a Social Security pension, because I've been in private sector long enough to do that as well, and I will have an offset as well. I don't know. I want to make it clear to everybody who's listening, for those people who don't understand this issue, if you work from one job and you go to another job and you pay into different pension systems, nobody ever tells you you can't collect both those pensions. It's not like you're double dipping. It's a matter of two different jobs at two different times, and you're entitled to get your entire pension from that. So the problem with this particular issue is, again, the amount of money. Right now, as you said, Ian, I think there's 14 states. I think that sounds right. Massachusetts is one of them. And right now, people like me are trying to find ways to say, okay, if we can't get the whole thing done right now because it's just too much money, okay, I'm a big boy, what can we get? How can we begin the process of making this right? Basically, what we have said to millions of Americans is, yes, you can qualify for two pensions legitimately, legally, even the right way. You can work for 20 years in the private sector and another 20 years in the public sector, and somehow you don't get those two full pensions. And those of us who are trying to push this are going to try to find ways to at least come up with a compromise. Again, I think there should be no need for a compromise because it's straightforward. You earn the money. Simple. But unfortunately, because the amounts of money that are now involved, it's been this way for so long, it will be hard to catch it up. But all I can tell you is that there are many of us who want to do it, and those people outside that understand this issue and are caught in this issue, you really have to call your member of Congress to make sure that they understand that you still want to be treated fairly.
Thank you. And with that, we are concluding our first telephone community meeting. We apologize for those of you that we were not able to get to. If you would like to leave a question or a comment, you may just stay on the line, and you can leave a message in a voicemail for Congressman Capuano. You can listen to an audio transcript of this community meeting on our website sometime in the next couple of days. And you may also sign up for our electronic newsletter via our website, which is www.house.gov/Capuano. And with that, I know Congressman Capuano would like to say thanks as well.
Well, I just want to thank all of you for joining us. This was our first telephone community meeting. I don't think we had too many technical glitches, but I hope you enjoyed it as much as I do. I actually love these things, and I'm always sad to see them end. At the same time, my hope is that we'll be doing this again, and maybe we'll do another one maybe in September, and then regularly thereafter. This is a relatively easy way for me to reach out to people. And for those of you who don't get our newsletter, I would strongly encourage you to sign up if you care about these issues. We send it out on average of once a week, sometimes even more. Maybe in August we may slow down a little bit. But it keeps you up without the filter of a news organization getting between you and the actual facts, including votes and different issues. And for those of you who we didn't get to your questions, I apologize, but you understand that time is short in life. And I look forward to doing this again, and again, thank you all for joining us, and good night.